This morning we have three matters on the oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Diamond Shamrock Refining Company and Others versus Donna Hall from Bexar County and the 4th Appellate District. George E. Sire Jr. and Others versus Carlo Robertson Cummings from Harris County and the 7th Appellate District. And Kirk and Suzanne Martin versus William and Carolyn Francis Ammerman from Jefferson County and the 6th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the argument by lunch. And if you wish to purchase a tape of any argument, you may do so by making application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Diamond Shamrock versus Hall.
Okay, please, the court. Well, Mr. Phil Boyce will present an argument for the petitioners, and the petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The court is being called upon here to reconcile widely divergent views about how a case such as this should be tried and submitted. The record here shows disagreement with respect to whether the gross negligence predicate for awarding punitive damages has been satisfied, and also how the exemplary damages caps apply in an employee death case brought under the workers' compensation statute. Based on a 10-2 jury verdict finding that Mr. Hall's employer was grossly negligent, the trial court signed a judgment awarding exemplary damages of $200,000, which of course was far less than the $42.5 million found by the jury. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's judgment and remanded this case for a new trial with directions to admit evidence and obtain jury findings on actual damages. We submit that this remand is in contravention of this court's teaching in Wright versus Gifford Hill. We believe that the Court of Appeals erred first because, as the dissenting justice recognized, there is no evidence to support a gross negligence finding. Apart from legal sufficiency, the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the trial court's correct application of the $200,000 maximum cap mandated by Chapter 41's unambiguous terms under the circumstances of this case.
Can you tell me what sort of evidence you think would constitute a scintilla of evidence to support gross negligence under the fact scenario here? What type of evidence would you be looking for to support an award?
I think you have to focus on the risk at issue, and I think that's a significant area where the parties have disagreement.
Let's say you define the risk as liquid in the discharge line. If that's the definition of the risk, then what sort of evidence do you think is necessary to get you to gross negligence, to the subjective element?
I think if there had been evidence of prior accumulations in the discharge side, then that may be a circumstance that gets you closer or gets you over the hurdle with respect to gross negligence. But I want to zero in because on this record, it is undisputed that there had not been prior accumulations on the discharge side.
Okay, but is there any other evidence? I mean, such as what if a key safety component has failed or you know it's failed?
Well, I think that what the court may be referring to, for example, would be the check valve evidence. And I would want to make the point that the exact nature of the issue with respect to the check valve is not entirely clear. There is some evidence of some kind of issue with the check valve, but it's not entirely clear.
You dispute the quality of that evidence. But what if, let's just use a hypothetical, not this case, what if there was evidence that, let's say there was a memo that the check valve was broken and it was not fixed? Would that be some evidence to you to support gross negligence?
I think if there were a context that there were an appreciation that liquids could get in on a discharge side, and that were the backdrop against which the memo that you're hypothesizing were entered, then that might be a different case, but that's not our case here. And I also don't want to lose sight of a point with respect to the standard of review, because it would be our position under this court's decision in JFC that asking whether there is a scintilla is not consistent with the clear and convincing evidence standard that's been required. I think it's more of a standard of could a reasonable juror conclude that clear and convincing evidence is present. And so I don't want to, I do want to note that position of ours.
But presuming that the existence of the check of the safety valve itself indicates that there it is foreseeable there's some risk of liquid in the discharge line, else there wouldn't be a safety valve. Would some knowledge that a valve is broken, I understand that you're not saying that's this case, but would some knowledge of a broken valve or a failure of a safety check get you there?
I think that it gets you closer to there, but I think it's helpful to answer your question by way of an analogy, because what I understand your question to be is, should further steps have been taken over and beyond what was already done? And I think that takes us to a circumstance that's similar to the Ung case, for example, where the contention was that additional better precautions should have been taken to protect the road worker from the risk.
I'm not talking about failure to train employees. I'm not talking about better policies. I'm talking about actual knowledge of a failed safety system in what's known to be a dangerous environment. Just that. You know something is broken and has failed and you don't fix it.
I think that depending on the circumstances, that could be evidence of gross negligence, but I focus on the circumstances here and bring it back to the what is the undisputed fact here, that there had not been liquid accumulation before in the discharge side of this compressor system. The folks who were on the ground there did not anticipate it, had not encountered it in the course of hundreds or perhaps thousands of startups. And so under those circumstances, in light of that undisputed fact, I think evidence, even if you grant every inference to the plaintiff in terms of that there was a check valve report and there was some malfunction in some way, I still don't think that gets them to where they've crossed the gross negligence threshold. And part of your question, I think, focuses on where the Court of Appeals went awry in its analysis, because it comes back to how are we going to define the risk at issue here? Is the risk at issue working around petrochemicals in a refinery? Is the risk defined as any means by which liquids can get into a compressor? Or is the risk defined as the risk that liquids would accumulate in a place where they hadn't before on the discharge side and get in?
And Mr. Royce, that's sorry to interrupt you, but following up on Justice O'Neill's question and what you just stated, was there any evidence in the record at any place what the likelihood was that, or the chances were, that the liquids would actually enter the compressor? Did any expert, any type of testimony?
The liquid, in terms of percentages, odds, or that sort of thing, no, I don't believe that there was evidence. What the evidence did show, at least with respect to the discharge side, is that it hadn't accumulated there before, and that was not the anticipated point of entry. There had been an anticipated possibility of entry of liquids from the suction side, and that was addressed through the various safeguards that were imposed prior incidents involving the suction line. But I think this brings us back to the Ung case and also the Andrade case, and the notion that responding to the prior incidents and imposing and introducing protections with respect to the suction side, I think is perfectly appropriate. But I don't think you can take that and say that because you didn't anticipate it on the discharge side and you didn't go above and beyond a check valve, that is gross negligence.
How many times before had the hydrocracker unit flooded the RLE compressor system with liquids?
I don't know that there was specific testimony as to the number of times. I think that the evidence was that this was an unusual additional amount of liquids that carried over from the hydrocracker unit into the RLE.
But had there ever been startups after previous times where there had been shutdowns and startups after that had happened?
I don't know that the evidence specifically reflected that this precise scenario had come about before. I think there was some anticipation that liquids could be carried over from the hydrocracker unit to the compressor unit in terms of as being part of the vapor. But in terms of the additional quantity that came over on the day of this incident, I don't think this precise chain of circumstances had previously been encountered. There was a risk, a recognized risk in terms of It's agreed. Everybody wants to keep liquids out of the compressors. But in terms of this specific dynamic, I don't believe that this had happened before. And certainly, even granting that there may be circumstances where liquids come over in some quantity from the hydrocracker unit to the compressor unit, again, it's undisputed on this record that in terms of an accumulation in the discharge side, that had not been experienced
before.
Why
was the hydrocracker unit... It sounds from the respondent's briefs that this was an intentional thing, that it was a conscious decision to cause the hydrocracker unit to flood the RL system with liquids. Is that true or not?
I think where the plaintiffs are drawing that from is evidence that there was a request on behalf of one of the hydrocracker operators to divert liquids away from the compressor unit, the RLE unit, and that request had been made to do that and permission was denied. So I guess that's the notion that it was intentionally sending it over there. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that the compressor unit, in the design of the compressor unit, it was contemplated that liquids could be present under some circumstances. That's why you have a low-stage suction drum. That's why you have an accumulator pot, so that the liquids would gather there and be taken away and not go further on into the compressor. But in terms of a contention that somebody had a desire to cause an explosion.
No, that's not what I meant.
Why were
the liquids diverted this way this time? If you say that it wasn't a normal procedure, why was it done that way this time?
I'm not sure that it's clear beyond the statement in the record that permission was requested and denied to divert them. And ultimately, I think at about 3:30 or so on the day of the incident, the compressor operators took it upon themselves to close off the valve and stop the carryover. But prior to that time, it had continued. And that may have been a function of the fact that there was some evidence that the hydrocracker unit may have been running at a higher temperature than normal, creating more liquid than normal under normal operations.
What's the purpose of the check valve?
The purpose of the check valve is to prevent backflow. And to prevent one of the aspects that it addresses is backflow that could cause the machinery to be damaged in the event of a shutdown or where it's not operating. There was some conflicting testimony as to the propriety of using a check valve as a means of preventing liquid from going backwards as opposed to vapors. But the bottom line is that it was there as part of a redundant series of protections. It was the check valve, it was a block valve beyond that, and then you've got, as I mentioned before, the low-stage suction drum that is there to capture liquids that may come over from the hydrocracker unit.
So, but isn't it, I mean, if there are safety features designed to prevent this from happening, then it would be foreseeable that this type of thing could happen.
I think the best analysis of it is in the dissenting justice's opinion. When we talk in terms of foreseeability and that sort of a thing, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that this is best practices or anything, but I think I would tell you that at most what we're talking about is evidence of negligence, and that the additional threshold is required to cross over into gross negligence is not satisfied here. And I think that was the point of the dissent, that they realized that the subjective prong, the conscious indifference, is not here, particularly when nobody knew that the liquids had accumulated on that day and it hadn't happened before. And again, I come back to this notion that...
There is some evidence of conscious indifference in general by at least some of the Diamond Shamrock management to the health and safety of the employees. Is there not?
Without tying it specifically to a particular risk,
well,
I'm not sure how to answer your question.
Okay. Not tying it to a risk, just management sitting there saying, we hope all our workers will be safe and we're doing everything we can to ensure that. There's some evidence of a failure in that regard.
I think there's evidence of negligence on this record. Now, is the contention going to be that that goes beyond to gross negligence? To me, that sounds very much like a contention that working in a petrochemical refinery is an inherently hazardous undertaking, and therefore anything that goes wrong in the course of that must be conscious indifference. It must be gross negligence, because everyone knows if something goes wrong in a refinery, bad things may well happen. I don't think that's the standard. I think that departs from the two-prong objective and subjective tests that have been set out. And again, I go back to the Ung case as an example where the concept of inherent hazard was not sufficient without being able to satisfy the specific prongs to establish gross negligence. You could just as well say it's inherently hazardous to work next to busy traffic on a freeway and not have a concrete retaining wall and a flag man and a buffer lane there to protect the workers from anything that might travel over from the lanes where the traffic
lies. Well, I had a question in general that's really not addressed by the briefs, but it seems like refineries have been around for a long time and have been operated for a long time, and you would think that by now you'd have a standard design for this type of situation. Is that not true? What was the evidence about that?
I don't know that there was evidence of a standard design. I think that there was evidence that these plants develop over time. They are expanded over time, developed over time, designed over time, and in the course of circumstances where it becomes apparent that there is a risk, for example, the prior incidents involving the suction line, then the appropriate design response was made to address that understood risk. I see that my red light is on.
I have just a few questions. Wouldn't it be a fair reading of the legislation and its clear intent to treat workers' compensation benefits as damages? And make the calculation the legislature clearly intended to be made from that?
I don't think that the four corners of the statute reveal such an intent, and to the extent that legislative history is consulted, I don't think that makes it clear either. I think that to the extent that there was some discussion of it, what we've been able to find in terms of the legislative history is set out at pages 530 through 551 of the clerk's record. We found a passing reference to a circumstance, what do you do with the caps when there's no actual economic damages? But in terms of some kind of a detailed analysis that the legislature said, well, we understand that this impacts workers' comp situation in this way, and here's how we're going to address it. I don't see that in the legislative history. And so you're left with the bare terms.
But they wanted this to be an overarching statute to prevail over any other law to the extent of any conflict.
Well, I guess I'm approaching it from the understanding that there's a presumption that when the legislature acts, it acts with knowledge and anticipation of the existing law, which in this case is Wright versus Gifford Hill. When the exemption for workers' comp was taken out of the damages cap in 95, Wright versus Gifford Hill had been on the books for several years. So I think when you operate from the presumption that's reflected, for example, in this court's Palacios case, that the legislature knows what the state of the law is when it acts, then I don't know that assumption is warranted. I think the four, you're left with the four corners of the way the statute reads.
One other legal question. Did you preserve your objection to the single business enterprise theory at the charge conference?
Yes, we did. And I would direct the court's attention to the charge objection that was made, which was in terms of no evidence as to the propriety of submitting Ultramar in connection with the punitive damages question.
And how could that be harmful error if you've got statutory caps? I mean, say it was error to admit the evidence of Ultramar's network, but if you've got a cap, where's the harm?
Well, I guess there's harm in two respects. Number one, the way this judgment reads, there is an exemplary damages award in some amount, and there is a reflecting of a gross negligence finding against Ultramar, which wasn't even submitted in the jury charge in terms of being Mr. Hall's employer. Secondly, the Alamo versus Krauss factors reflected in the statute contemplate that net worth is something that's got to be considered. And regardless of however the cap operates, I think it's if reasonable proportionality and protections that are reflected in the Alamo versus Krauss factors are going to have any meaning, you need to get the net worth right. in terms of how what the jury is presented with. So I don't think that saying that there's a cap is necessarily a complete answer to this question, is single business enterprise appropriately submitted? And recognizing that my light is on, if I may give a further answer to your question, Chief Justice Phillips, in terms of preservation, I would also point out that in addition to the charge objection, the written charge objection that appears at page 263 of the clerk's record and was expressly overruled at page 295 of the clerk's record, you need to understand that the objection with respect to single business enterprise came against a backdrop of a continuing dialogue during the trial leading up to this issue. I think the most analogous circumstance is this court's discussion of preservation in Southeastern Pipeline versus Tahache. In response to a contention in that case that the charge objection had been waived, the court went back and looked at discussion of what had led up to that during the course of the trial. The bottom line here is, did the trial court understand the nature of Diamond Shamrock's complaint? And I think the answer is unequivocal. When you have, I would give just a couple of additional sites. Volume 10 of the reporter's record at page 8, volume 8 of the reporter's record, page 85 through 87. Even plaintiff's counsel told the trial court that the trial court needed to submit a question. That appears at pages 7 and 8 of volume 10 and page 88 of volume 8. Bottom line test in terms of preservation. Did the trial court understand what Diamond Shamrock's complaint was? The answer is, I believe, unequivocally yes. And under those circumstances, I believe the charge objection that was made is more than sufficient, even if you assume the charge objection was required. Essentially, this was a directed verdict with respect to single business enterprise, so I'm not sure that you even need to get to the charge objection stage. But if you assume that some objection was made, I think this record clearly shows the trial court understood what Diamond Shamrock's concern was.
Mr. Boyce, part of your brief suggests your position that this explosion occurred as the unlikely consequence of a series of unlikely events all happening simultaneously. What briefly, just set those out in a list form for me. The parties argue back and forth about it. What are those?
The circumstances.
The check valve, the bleeder valve.
Starting out with a circumstance where there is a greater than usual presence of liquids, which fills up the low-stage suction drum, the accumulator pot. You have a circumstance then where the operators look at to see if that's all drained out. It has to their site. It appears that there's no liquid presence. But you have a circumstance where the check valve has leaked, which has allowed liquid to get behind it and pool next to the block valve on the discharge side. There's also some conflicting evidence in terms of the block valve leaking. It wasn't clear in the record whether that leak was before or contemporaneous with the event that occurred. But nonetheless, you have a circumstance where the liquid arguably gets past the block valve, then the block valve is opened up and the pooled liquids go up through a recirculating line, come in through the top, hook up to the suction line, and then are drawn into the compressor from the top. That's the sequence of events as I understand it, and I continue to ask the court to focus on the undisputed fact that a liquid accumulation on the discharge side had not occurred before.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Well, may it please the court. Well, Mr. Joe Lovell and Mr. Christopher Dean will present argument for the respondents, and Mr. Joe Lovell will open the roll.
And please, court. The law is meaningless unless there's consequences. And here, Diamond Shamrock has avoided the consequences of moving for judgment on the verdict, the consequence being that they waived their sufficiency claim. And here, of course, we've gone through this entire appellate process and we're focused primarily on sufficiency. In addition, they've avoided the consequences of inducing the trial court into the very error that forms most of the other claims in this case. Diamond Shamrock intentionally created this mess, and as a result, the law says there is stopped to benefit from it by application of the cap. First, though, I'll address legal sufficiency of the evidence. Perhaps the best way to do it is to go straight to Justice Wainwright's question a moment ago for a list of the primary things which show, the evidence which shows that there was conscious indifference, the subjective element. First, and this is the greatest distinction that Diamond Shamrock does not address, and that is that the liquids were placed in the vapor-only system, and it was done knowingly. The reason that this hasn't arisen before is because Diamond Shamrock never knowingly and intentionally violated its own safety procedures to put those liquids into this system.
Is your complaint in that regard a complaint about the design of the system or about the operation? You seem to go back and forth.
That's part of the whole thing. There are several things, Your Honor, that go together, but that's the starting place.
That being
the intentional flooding of the RLE vapor-only system. In contravention of their own procedure, and in contravention, of course, as you've seen in the briefs, of all the complaints and phone calls and that kind of thing. But that was the start of it. Now, unlike Andrade, which dealt with a situation of electricity, the electricity can be turned on and off. And if it's off, there's no danger. With this system and under these circumstances, the liquids, once they're put there, they have to be removed. And there's no question about that. There is no dispute about that by anybody throughout the record. If there are liquids in this system, they have to be removed because even as their own expert said, even a small portion, a small quantity of liquid in a compressor will result in a rupture with absolute certainty. That was the term. Now, take that and combine it with the design. If I can approach Diamond Shamrock designed, and this is a diagram of just the part in question. They designed this system after prior explosions, and this particular system was designed to take liquids, this is the underground pot that's talked about, take liquids and drop them into the discharge line. Now, under normal, I'll just carry you through the flow. They drop into the discharge line. If it's a small amount of liquids, just the kind of liquids that might drop out of the vapors under normal circumstances, and the compressors are running, then the pressure and flow of gas coming out of the compressor will then take those small amount of liquids, carry them on out of the system. The problem here was they flooded this to such an extent that they had to shut this down. The reason is where the gases are coming in is into this suction drum. It doesn't show it on this diagram. But they come into this suction drum, and it is designed to catch any liquids that may fall out. Of course, they overfilled the suction drum. We had alarms, that kind of thing. So they had to shut it down so that it wouldn't go directly into the suction compressor. They shut it down. They flood these liquids without the compressor running and with such volumes, you had nothing to carry it out. And the way this is designed, these pipes, it doesn't show it here, but they're all inclined back towards the compressor. So we have the force of gravity, we have the force of back pressure, which is in this interstage accumulator, pushing it back. This is the check valve in question. And then dropping it, force of gravity right down to the lowest point in this entire system, except for this accumulator, is right here in the discharge of the compressor. The startup procedure, which is another portion of this, Justice Wainwright, requires that to start this back up, they close a bypass valve so that the discharge then circulates straight into the suction. So there's no load on the engine until they get warmed up. Then they open the discharge valve. And then, as long as everything's okay, then they open the suction valve. That creates the load and starts moving the gas. By having that situation, by knowingly flooding the system, they were putting liquids into this system that they designed to force them back to this very point so that when the engine is running, they open the discharge valve, the liquids rush in from this point here, get caught in circulation straight into the suction, and it ruptured.
The suction lines are what color compared to the discharge lines?
I didn't distinguish the suction versus the discharge, Your Honor. If you look, you've got this in a handout. They've got arrows here. And really, this particular diagram doesn't focus on the the suction side. This one does. You got this too. This is another diagram prepared. This is a little harder to understand, but it's 3D. Here is the suction side coming into that suction drum. And so then, under normal operations, it will be coming in here to the top. When you have a startup, this is closed off here through this valve. And then first, this closed off, the bypass valve here is open so that it can cycle. Then the block valve is open, and that allows these liquids then to rush in.
Are the bleeder valve and the ball valve, their sole purpose is to prevent liquid from entering the system?
No.
And to prevent backflow?
As to the ball valve, it has multiple functions. The primary function under normal circumstances to prevent backflow and just to shut that system off. Now the bleeder valve, of course, that's another one of the elements. This bleeder valve was designed into the system back in 1981 when they built this shortly after these two prior explosions. That is this valve right here. It's just like a little drain. Diamond Shamrock contends that its only function and the only design to it was that was put in so that when it was built, this system could be hydrostatically tested, which is precisely the point. They put liquids. That's the last time they intentionally put liquids into this system, is when they hydrostatically tested. They needed that drain there so that they could drain the liquids out before they started operating. That's why it was there. Now, in addition, in that connection, there is evidence that the operator in the feed prep unit, when this first started happening around noon, when the liquids first started coming over, his name was Stephen Hendricks. He testified that he knew about that drain valve. And he testified that when he first learned about it in the 80s from his boss, Elmer Schneider, who told him that liquids could get in that portion of the discharge line, and if they did, they could get carried up into the suction and cause a rupture. He knew about that. Mr. Chambly, who was a crude unit supervisor, he testified that he had used that very bleeder valve several years before to release pressure during a maintenance operation. So he knew about it. And then what we had happen on April 1st is that once the hydrocracker unit started producing all these liquids and refused to follow procedure and divert those liquids to the torch, that the liquids came in here. They came in during Mr. Hendricks' shift. Then Mr. Thornburg, Kevin Smith, and Charlie Hall, their crew came on approximately 3 o'clock. They met with them at 3:30. At that point, by about that time, about 3 o'clock, finally, Gary Schnaufer in the hydrocracker unit defied orders and diverted to storage. He had to defy orders to do that, to divert those liquids. Then they started the process of draining what they knew. They drained the liquid accumulator, the suction drum. They even drained the high stage, which is kind of a different issue, but they drained. And once everything that was drained that they knew about, then they were instructed to start up, and that's when it happened.
The petitioner says we should focus on the fact that no liquid had accumulated on the discharge side before. What's your response to that?
The response is that no liquid had accumulated there before because the hydrocracker unit had never knowingly sent liquids over there. That is entirely against procedure to do that.
And is it fair to say that, sort of bottom line, what the plaintiff has to prove for this subjective prong is that Diamond Shamrock either built or operated the plant without caring whether it was going to blow up or not?
No, that's an overstatement.
Okay.
Here, it would be that they were aware of the risk in question, and in defining that risk, the risk is putting liquids into this vapor system.
Which means it's going to blow up.
Unless something is done to remove those liquids, that's right.
But so then isn't the bottom line that the subjective prong means, the conscious indifference part, means that Diamond Shamrock either built or operated the plant without caring whether it would blow up or not. And it's kind of hard to see why you would do that.
No. Well, that would be intentional. And here is a question of gross neglect. So it becomes whether they're aware of the risk and were consciously indifferent to that risk. A good analogy, we think, is the Seminole Pipeline case, where you had the pipeline company that built this cavern themselves. They designed it, and it was a cavern where liquid gases went in and were offset with brine. And the key component there was to keep track of how much liquid gas they had in there so that it wouldn't come back up through the brine stem. There, it's really a fairly similar situation. They knew that if they allowed liquids to come up through the brine stem, that the gas would then escape, would turn to gas escape, and could cause an explosion problem. So it wasn't a question there of whether or not they were indifferent to an explosion. It was a question of whether they were indifferent to the things they had subjective awareness of to prevent that explosion. And that's what we have here, is they were indifferent. Once they put those liquids in, defy procedure and put those liquids in, then it is incumbent upon them, given their knowledge of what will happen with even a small amount of liquid, it is incumbent upon them to do whatever it takes to get all the liquids out before they start that compressor up and to know it. And if that requires going to the office and opening a drawer and pulling out the piping and instrumentation diagram and seeing that bleeder valve, well, then that's what they should have done. Here we even had evidence that certain people involved in this knew about that bleeder valve, but the shift changed, they went off, and then Charlie Hall and his crew ended up paying the price for that. So there's more than sufficient evidence to support the finding.
Do you,
in addition,
agree,
the other yes,
you agree it has to be clear and convincing.
Yes, if Chapter 41 applies, it's clear and convincing standard. This was tried assuming that. The jury was instructed clear and convincing, and we tried it that way. The jury found it that way. The one other aspect, actually two other aspects that I hadn't touched on with respect to evidence are the check valve, which has been touched on before, and evidence that that very check valve had been reported. And if you'll notice, that very check valve is Diamond Shamrock's only. It is the only thing they can rely on. And the evidence was clear and convincing, that even had it not malfunctioned, it still would not have prevented this because check valves leak liquids. Their own expert said that. Their own safety manager said that. Check valves are not designed to hold liquids. They're designed, Justice O'Neill, to prevent reverse flow, which can reverse the equipment. And then lastly is we talked about the startup procedure. Prior in the feed prep unit where this happened, prior to it happening, the procedure was that when you start it up, like I explained, put it on bypass, you start running it. First, you run it with air. Then, as the pistons start moving, you replace that with fuel gas so that it starts running on its own. Once it's warmed up, then they open the discharge valve first that's down on the low part, then open the suction valve. At the same time, in April of 1996, in the hydrocracker unit, which also has an RLE compressor system, they had a procedure which required that they crack a bleeder valve at the very bottom. If I can approach again, I'll show you how that worked. In the hydrocracker unit, their bleeder was located on this what's called a discharge snubber. The procedure is to, before you start it up, you crack the discharge valve so that any liquids that are in that portion of the line will run past the discharge valve to that lowest point. Then you open the bleeder valve to see if there's any liquids. If there's liquids, then you don't start the compressor. You do whatever it takes to get the liquids out. That was in the hydrocracker unit on April 1st of 1996. Under the Ellender case, that by itself is evidence sufficient to support the gross negligence finding. Very quickly, let me touch upon some of the other aspects surrounding Chapter 41. First, as applied in this case, Chapter 41 is unconstitutional. The reason being really twofold. The application that happened was that we were not allowed to put on evidence of actual damages. Now, as applied then, and as Diamond Shamrock argues it's supposed to apply, a plaintiff is not entitled to an award of exemplary damages unless there is an award of actual damages, compensatory and non-compensatory. Now, they then say, to try to avoid the constitutionality problem, they then say, well, that means the cap is automatically $200,000. But they can't piecemeal the statute because the statute says that there has to be a quote-unquote award of actual damages in order to have a quote-unquote award of exemplary damages.
Are you saying it's unconstitutional because of open courts or unconstitutional because of the provision about gross negligence in death cases?
Both, actually. As to the open courts, Your Honor, by applying it that way, the actual effect of that is that a plaintiff, the cap isn't $200,000, it's zero, if it's applied as they say. And so the effect is that a plaintiff is denied their due course of law because while there may be a cause of action, there is no remedy because you can't put on any evidence to support your cause of action. So the effect is denial of due course of law as sought to be applied by Diamond Shamrock.
Are you splitting time?
We're playing it by ear depending upon what questions the court had. And so far, we've dealt with my issues. So if you ask the right question, I'll punt the ball to Chris.
That's a magic word.
The other aspect is Section 26, Article 16. And the position has been taken throughout, including the court below, that it cannot be unconstitutional because exemplary damages are a public right. And open courts provision only protects private remedies. But that does not focus on the actual language of the constitutional amendment, which says that companies shall be responsible to the survivors of the deceased person. It doesn't say to the public. It actually says it will be responsible to those people in exemplary damages. And I think that language, there's a difference there. So it's our position that is involved in private rights, so that does raise constitutional implications.
Does that mean our decision a few years ago was wrong, or which, just distinguish?
Which decision?
I'll come back to that.
Okay. I haven't seen that I can remember any decision that directly addressed that, Your Honor, that particular thing. Now, if statute does apply, and we say it doesn't for the legislative because the legislature amended it out and then had to come back in and amend it in 1997, but if it does apply, then the statute is simple, it's straightforward, and it tells trial courts what they're supposed to do.
What's your strongest evidence that Diamond Shamrock anticipated that there would be liquors in that discharge area?
All of the evidence surrounding what happened in the hydrocracker unit.
I mean, they had safety provisions in place to prevent, I mean, the whole design was to prevent liquids from getting there because they realized the danger of an explosion. So that, why would we not assume that if they had anticipated there'd be liquid there, that they would have guarded against it?
If that were right, they would have never sent those liquids over to begin with. Because in the hydrocracker procedures, it is procedure that if liquids start carrying over from the overhead fractionator into the RLE system, they are to divert those liquids to storage or to the torch. They were asked to do that. They were denied permission to do that.
Why? Do we know?
There's not a real clear answer. There's some suggestion that the operator that was in charge of starting up on this occasion thought he might need more liquids, but there's also evidence that really couldn't have been the reason because they still had plenty of liquids.
What do you need more liquids to start up?
It's all part of our process, and those liquids, the plant doesn't just dispose of liquids. It uses them and ultimately sells them. But as part of the whole fractionator startup process, liquids, some amount of liquids are run back through as part of the cooling process. But here they had way too many liquids, and so they were using them to try to cool it down. And even doing that, they still had liquids, and they refused to divert to the torch. And the simple fact of the matter is, if it goes to the torch, they burn it up and they can't use it or sell it or anything else. So, I mean, that's the real difference. The so-called safeguards to prevent liquids from getting into the compressor are put in place for the normal kind of expectation that you have that some liquids, some small amount of liquids, can fall out of the gas stream during normal operating process. And we don't deny that. That's true. But here, they put them in there on purpose. And that's what changes this case from just a cold day where there's more liquids than usual falling out into the first stage suction drain.
And was there any evidence that they had done that before?
No, there wasn't.
One way or the other. Was a record silent, or was there affirmative evidence that they'd never sent liquids over from the hydro cracker unit?
I don't believe there was affirmative evidence. My recollection is just repeated statements that this particular thing had never happened before. And then the evidence from almost all of the personnel in the hydrocracker unit that this was contrary to procedure. They always diverted any liquids to storage or to the torch.
But I thought you said they used liquids sometimes to start it up.
An excess of liquids. That's true. Some of the liquids go back through into the circulation, but if they're getting an excess of liquids, then that's why the whole plant is set up with the systems where they can divert liquids, they can divert pressure. Ultimately, that goes to the torch line, so that if there's some surge in pressure or extra liquids or things like that, they can get rid of them in a hurry before they become a problem by running them out to the torch and burning them up. And so that's what was going on here, and that's what the request was, divert to the torch, divert to the torch, divert to the torch.
Any other questions?
We ask the court to reverse and render judgment on the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to begin on rebuttal by addressing Justice Jefferson's question in terms of evidence with respect to an expectation that there would be liquids on the discharge side. I think that the evidence in the briefing that the plaintiffs pointed to try to get there is addressed in our reply brief at pages 14 through 15 of the record at pages 80 through 82. But I think when the court looks at that testimony, what the court will see is that is testimony whereby it is acknowledged that if liquids get in, they will cause an explosion or bust the compressor. I don't think that's tantamount to evidence that they were expected to get in on the discharge side. I think it's part of this larger piece of evidence, which again is not disputed, that liquids need to be kept out of compressors.
As long as there's a bleeder on the RLE compressor in the hydrocracker unit, but not a bleeder on this one.
I think it was in anticipation. I think the bleeder valves, you may be thinking of the suction side.
He said that there was a valve, I forgot what he said, was attached, some sort of nut that was in place that they used to drain liquids off before startup in the hydrocracker unit, but they didn't have that kind of bleeder valve over
there. There was not a bleeder valve on the discharge side, and what there was there was a drain valve, and I'll address that in terms of the hydrostatic testing first. But the bottom line is, I come back to the undisputed fact, where there was an anticipation of a need to drain hydrocarbons from the line, then there was a drain valve or bleeder valve installed there. That was the anticipation on the discharge side. The drain valves that were located there had been used solely for the purpose.
The hydrocracker unit, was there a valve on the discharge side over there on the compressor?
I'm not sure that the record was clear on that, and I think that the clearer question was that the drain valves that were used in recognition of the risks that were anticipated, and it wasn't anticipated on this side. And I think there's also this notion that trying to get to the notion that liquids had absolutely no presence being in the RLE system at all. Again, you've got protections there that recognize there can be liquids under some circumstances. The thought that the tie-in there is somehow tantamount to funneling liquids directly into the compressor from the discharge side, I don't think that's borne out by the record. And I would specifically direct the court to plaintiff's expert testimony, Mr. McCannich, at volume 5 of the record, page 46, where he testified that the tie-in that was referenced here is 12 to 15 feet away from the valves that are of concern. So in retrospect, this all came together in a way to cause this incident. But I don't think the record supports a contention that the tie-in was located such that it would directly channel liquids into the compressor from the discharge side. I also want to note briefly, in terms of visualizing all this, the piping and instrumentation drawings are here. I find it easier, and I would direct the court's attention to Plaintiff's Exhibit 30, which is more of a, not so much a to scale or technical drawing, but just a representation of the system. It's also reprinted in page 432 of the clerk's record in terms of visualizing what was going on here. And I think when you look at those visualizations, whether you do it here or those, a suggestion that it was funneled directly into the discharge line and into the compressor that way is not borne out.
And they keep saying that the check valve was the only equipment that would prevent this. Is that, and that you knew that would leak?
I would direct you to Mr. McCannich's testimony again, page 158 through 160, where he was led through a statement of what were the redundant backup systems here for protections. You've got a check valve, certainly, but that's not the only thing. You've got the low-stage suction drum, and you also have the block valve. So I don't think it would be accurate on the record to say that the check valve was the sole and only line of defense.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.